This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell. On today's show, we return to a time considered by many as an age of innocence and reflect on memoirs of childhood. Esther Freud tells me about the writing of Hideous Kinky from the perspective of her four-year-old self.
As a child, I held the memories of my time in Morocco, which lasted for a year and a half or so, very, very close.
Audiobook user Po Sim revisits one of her favourite books and the rites of passage at the heart of To Kill a Mockingbird.
They were sure that Atticus, the dad, had got him off, but the jury, of course, had to find him guilty.
And the RNIB library team review Sue Perkins' memoir, Spectacles.
Now, Julie listened to it, and she chose to do it that way because she was intrigued by the different reading experience that she'd get, particularly with it being an autobiography.
And I'll be talking to Janice Galloway about her childhood novel, This Is Not About Me. A world where words and music were joyful secrets and domestic life veered between absurdity and dissolution.
We listened to the gulls in silence, watched a dog bolting from one side to the other of the sand, demented with a find of something dead.
So, settle down, and when you're sitting comfortably, we'll begin today's show. All of us have a shared experience of life, that is childhood. Whether we think of it as an idealised bubble, protected from the harsh realities of the adult world, or as a formative period, full of rich experiences, we've all gone through it. It's also a rich seam for many authors as they sift through the memories of their own growing up. The retelling of half-remembered events, seen through the prism of maturity, allows each author to colour their memories, some with humour and some with an understanding impossible at the time, but almost all with poignancy, as the younger self is exposed without the benefit of the wisdom that comes with the years. My first guest today was four when her mother turned her back on English convention and the father of her children and whisked her and her older sister away to live a nomadic life in Morocco. A quarter of a century later, she recalled the experience in her best-selling autobiographical novel, Hideous Kinky, which was also made into a successful film. While their mother seeks self-fulfillment through meditation and Sufism, the book's four-year-old narrator and her sister are free to explore the back streets of Marrakesh.
When the water boiled, he added a handful of wilting mint. Mum got up and came to sit by the fire. She'd slept in her blue kaftan, the kaftan Ahmed's aunt had given her when she was brought back from the brink of death. It was crumpled and warm around her body. I leant against her. The sun tickled patterns of heat into my back as we sat and drank our tea and watched the fire go out.
It's a rootless, hands-to-mouth existence, but seen through the eyes of a child, it's also rich and exotic. Esther Freud, thank you very much for joining us on Read On Air.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
The book has a wonderful bubbling feel to it, as if the story needed to be told. Did it write like that?
That's very interesting. It did need to be told, for me anyway. As a child, I held the memories of my time in Morocco, which lasted for a year and a half or so, very, very close. And when I came back to England, I was six. And for those next few years, living a much more traditional life in England, which seemed quite kind of grey and subdued compared to my North African experience, I felt people wouldn't know when they looked at me that I had this extraordinary story inside me. First, when I arrived back, my hair had been hennaed and it was quite orange and long and scraggly, and I had henna patterns on my hands. So people did know I was different, but slowly these things wore off. And I used to tell people, in Morocco, and my nickname at school became In Morocco, and I couldn't ever quite get them to understand how amazing it really was. So when I was 26, I sat down and I wrote what became Hideous Kinky, and it really freed me. It really freed me to be more present in the world. It was a really important thing that I did for myself.
Were the memories close to the surface? Were they that vivid?
The reason why it took me as long as it did to write it was because I didn't have enough memories to fill a book. I didn't know then what I know now about writing is no one knows everything that's going to go into a book when you start. It's what puts people off. But if you start, it's a bit like chipping away at a surface of a stone and there's something beautiful underneath. You remember more things or you have more ideas. I had a real breakthrough moment with it. And I was struggling. I started the idea really when I was about 22. So it took about 4 years for me to actually have the confidence and the discipline to sit down and write it. And one of the pieces of advice I got along the way was make it up. And that was because I was getting stuck and doing strange, complicated structural flashbacks, older child looking back. And I said, I can't make it up. It's my life. I don't remember enough to write a book, but I want to put these very vivid memories that I do have down. And she said, just try. You're allowed to do anything, you know. Give yourself permission. So I just wrote the first page, which is still the first page, became the first page of the book, right there and then. And it was these little children in a van traveling through Europe, heading for Morocco, which is what happened, but I have no memory of that. But I got the spirit of it. And then I started to think, it's just the spirit of the story that I need. And the details, well, who's to really remember exactly what every detail was? But there's a lot of things in there that are true and many things that are true that didn't get into the book.
I wonder if having a four-year-old narrator who everything is new to, so she can't be judgmental, and she is the ultimate innocent abroad. She can't read, write, speak the language. She doesn't even have a name. And so she's not passing judgment. She's just observing. Was that liberating as a writer, or did you find the naivety actually quite difficult discipline to stay within?
So interesting to hear it expressed like that. None of those things occurred to me when I started to write. I was thinking of my sort of 4-5-year-old self, this height that she was. I have actually one photograph from that stage of my childhood, and it's a face, the eyes looking up into the camera, many Moroccan beads around her neck, my neck, and some bunches with sort of English ribbon and a little caftan. And that was who was telling the story. And I looked at that photo and I told it from her perspective without any of the critical analytical thoughts that you've just presented, which are completely true and right. But when it was published, people said, how extraordinary to write a novel from the point of view of such a young child. And I thought, oh, I was just setting it down as it happened. I wasn't a writer and I hadn't studied English literature. I left school when I was 16 and studied drama. And I was never very academic, or certainly one thing I knew from the age of about 12 is I didn't want to go to university. So I was also, like my nameless narrator, new to this world. And it came very instinctively and naturally. And I found, oh, I wanted to tell stories. I thought I was going to tell stories through acting. It turns out I'm going to tell stories through writing. And that was it. I'm now on my 9th novel.
Absolutely. And they just get better and better. I love Hideous Kinky. And it was a wonderful first novel and a wonderful introduction to you. It's also a hymn to sisterhood. And I think my favourite part, actually, is when the two sisters gang up on one of their mum's more useless suitors, Pedro Patchbottom. And, of course, it's got that element of all great children's books, that it's the children against the mess that the adults have made. Did you write it with any children's books that were favourites of yours in mind, any children's authors?
I was definitely influenced by books like Little House on the Prairie, and there's a wonderful biography by Patricia Lynch, who's a wonderful children's writer, an Irish writer, Brogine and the Green Shoes, and she wrote a book about her own childhood. And those books really inspired me because I saw what I was doing as a child. In order to create some kind of semblance of maybe safety and sanity, I was always making stories up for myself out of what chaos was actually happening around me. And I saw that that's what those writers were doing with their own childhoods in different ways, making what was going on into a story and somehow exerting some kind of control over it. Not that I was thinking those things now, then, but I see that's what I was doing and why those books appealed to me so much.
And, of course, your narrator makes up stories to comfort her sister. And also she has recurring nightmares about the Black Hand herself, which you are Sigmund Freud's granddaughter. In some ways, were you trying to analyse an uncanny and upsetting incident in your own childhood then, do you think? Or was it a happier time than that?
I wasn't trying to analyse anything. I did have an absolute terror of the Black Hand. It was my fear, so I just used it. I just threw it in. I mean, I can see looking back, of course, you know, children are frightened. I mean, my own daughter, who has had a pretty stable life compared to mine, wouldn't go upstairs for years because she thought there was a monster under the bed. Children's imaginations are so vivid. It's so incredible. And I wasn't frightened of the Black Hand when I wasn't frightened of it. But when I was, it was so powerful. I couldn't move. And that haunted me for many years, actually. My memories of being particularly frightened are more when I was about 9. But I remember first hearing the story when I was about 5. So I used that without any thought that I was reflecting. But of course, instinctively as a writer, you're making light and shade all the time. There's wonderful, intoxicating, exciting adventures. And then, of course, just in order for the story to have an ebb and flow, you think, well, hang on, let's put the dark side in. I read a wonderful quote by Stendhal which said, think very hard about what you want to say in this book and try your hardest not to say it. And what I was doing when I was writing that book was staring at the sheet of paper, and I actually was sitting at my kitchen table with a sheet of paper and a pen, and I thought, I want to breathe into this story all the joy, extraordinary excitement, terror and insecurity that happened on that journey without ever saying that that's what's happening. And I just said, then we went to the lake. I left the reader to imagine all those other things.
And actually, rereading the book now, when I first read it, I didn't have children, and I think I had quite a lot of sympathy with the mother who was fed up with the constraints of living in Tunbridge Wells and wanted some colour in her life. And now rereading it with children of my own, I worry for their safety and think, the woman's so irresponsible. Did you find your own views of the events that went into the story have changed since you yourself became a mum?
I actually feel like I had exactly the opposite reaction to you. When I was writing the book, I did feel quite critical at times and quite sort of shocked by the sheer reality of what we all went through. But once I had children and the relentless sameness and boredom of it at times, much as I adored looking after them, I thought, God, good for mum. You know, she had so little money, so little security, and was quite ostracised from her own family and separated from our father. I mean, what does she have to lose? Good for her. I'm so proud of her.
Back in 1967, her children could even have been taken into care if she had been unfortunate. I guess, you know, things have changed a lot in the intervening years.
Yes, I think when my mother was incredibly supportive of me writing the book, and when she read it, she was very proud. But when the reviews came out and sort of said that she was irresponsible, you know, this mother is irresponsible and feckless, etc., she thought, no, I was sent off to boarding school when I was tiny. You know, just as you say, she came from a strict Catholic family who may well have had us taken away if they even knew we existed, and they didn't know we existed for some years. So I don't, if I could write the book again, and I would like to write all my books again, ideally, because they're never quite perfect when you have a chance to look back, I would have given maybe a little bit more of the reality of the background. But then again, as a very young narrator, I was trying to be true to what the child actually knew, and I didn't know that.
And actually, I think at the end of the book, the mother doesn't come out as careless of her children's well-being. She is just feeling her own way. And I one of the things that comes through the book is just how young she is as well.
When I was involved in the making of the film, I didn't have a huge amount of input, But I did really insist that the actress who played the mother was very young. And in fact, Kate Winslet was only about 21 when she made the film. But she's always been a very sort of womanly young girl when she was. And so she was absolutely fantastic. And she gave that quality of someone very earthy, but curious.
It is a fantastic book to any of the listeners who haven't read it. I thoroughly recommend it, and the rest of Esther Freud's books as well, which are available from the Talking Books Library.
Did you read it or did you listen to the audiobook? I'm curious.
I listened to the audiobook that's in the RNIB Talking Books Library, which is beautifully read.
I'm so proud of that because Kate Winslet was meant to do it, and at the last minute they said, oh, she can't do it. She's too busy launching Titanic. I went, oh, I'll do it. So I'm always very proud that I did do that.
It wasn't until we were halfway through France that we noticed Moretta wasn't talking. She sat very still in the back of the van and watched us all with bright eyes. I crawled across the mattress to her. Moretta, will you tell us a story? Moretta sighed and turned her head away. John was doing the driving. He was driving fast, with one hand on the wheel. John was Moretta's husband. He'd brought her along at the last minute, only because I heard him tell my mother she wasn't well.
Thanks again to Esther for joining us. Hideous Kinky is available as RNIB Talking Book Number 12097. And for what it's worth, I found it much more absorbing than the film adaptation. Do you have a best love book that speaks to your inner child? I'd love to hear from you. The address, if you need it, is readonair@rnib.org.uk.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories,
well,
told
like
live
to
on stage.
Lineup,
no scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth
Library.
Radio Hour is a
TV
mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
There are many myths around eyesight, but it is true that carrots are good for your eyes, as they are rich in vitamin A. It is also true that boys are more likely to be colorblind than girls. Looking directly at the sun will damage your sight, but wearing glasses will not make your eyes dependent on them or make your eyesight deteriorate more quickly. And it is true that dolphins sleep with one eye open.
Find out more by visiting rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
So, welcome back. Now, here on the show, we love to talk to people who are passionate about the written word. And who has more passion than those wonderful folk down at the RNIB Library? But the thing about passions is they run deep, and sometimes we find ourselves at odds with those around us. Edwina and Julie had both been reading Spectacles, Sue Perkins' memoir, and it didn't quite hit the same spot for both of them. Let's hear from Edwina.
Well, the Marmite book came about because we have our website, which is Let's Talk About Books, and we're putting together features and articles for that. And we were talking about the sort of things we could put on there, and we came up with the idea of the Marmite book because we have books that we've read and some of us have loved them, some of us have hated them. So we did Terry Pratchett, which, strange enough, I hated, and Andrew loved, which was his Going Postal. And then the one that's on the site this month is one between Tracy and Mark. And the one that Julie and I did was Spectacles by Sue Perkins. Now, Julie listened to it, and she chose to do it that way because she was intrigued by the different reading experience that she'd get, particularly with it being an autobiography. And for her, there were some real gems in the book, from bits that made her sniffle when she wrote a letter to her dead dog, Pickle, to proper belly laugh. And she apparently was listening to this while she was doing some walking and got strange looks from people as she strode out while laughing out loud. But she felt that, because the book is narrated by Sue Perkins, and she felt that that really lent itself to the format of the book, felt much like a conversational piece rather than a book, and probably closer to a stand-up comedy. And having read the book, I can see that that would have worked, because when I read it, to me, it was quite disjointed. She sort of stopped at certain points, and there is a diagnosis of a medical condition, for example. And then you go on to something else, and I thought, oh, did I miss the chapter? I actually went back to check. I hadn't missed the chapter, because it kind of left me hanging a bit. the childhood, I think for anyone who grew up around that time, it could almost have been sort of your childhood. It was very much the family, and she had a very sort of normal, natural upbringing. She does start at the beginning of the book by trying to pretend she's going to make her family into this sort of wonderful fantasy family where the brother's very attractive to all the women and the sister does things that she would love to do, but then after a few paragraphs says, no, this is never going to work, let's get back to reality, and tells it as it really was. Julie did say herself that there were some places there that she could have gone into greater detail, but for her that would have been at the expense of sort of the roller coaster of telling the whole story. I would have liked a bit more about the bake-off, to be honest, because having seen her sort of do that, I wanted to know a bit more about how it sort of all works and how she got into it with Mel. But she does sort of mention, she tells a story about going with her partner, taking the dog somewhere, and the dog is seriously ill in the car, and she's trying to get this dog out of the car, clean the car in the service station car park, and people are randomly shouting, bake, as they go past. And she does also talk about, she did a Dangerous Road series. She did two of them. She did one with Lisa Tarbuck and one with somebody else whose name escapes me. And she does go into a bit detail about that, which again, I did enjoy, because having watched those, it was nice to sort of come across the backstory of that, which was she was told when she started with a book, a series about interesting roads. And then when they got sort of into it and they went to make it a bit more dangerous, she says, but I thought it was called Interesting Roads. You know, didn't anybody tell you? No, it's actually called Dangerous Roads. So it was, as I say, just I've liked a bit more detail about a certain bit, but I can understand that maybe if you listen to it, it would be a very different reading experience to having read it.
Spectacles, written and read by me, Sue Perkins. I've always wanted to be a writer. Since I first felt the precarious wobble of a book in my hand. Since I first heard the phrase, once upon a time. Since I first realised that fairies, wizards and seafarers could transport you from the endless grey of 1970s South London. I was a prolific child. By the age of 7, I'd produced several anthologies of poems about God, death and aquatic birds. I was prolific right up to the point I received a B- for a haiku I'd written about a heron. The uninitiated can be so unkind.
When RNIB Scotland started producing talking books, one of the very first ones was Clara, written and read by Janice Galloway.
Half-light and rain. The path of the street shines along the rim of guttering. Look up. Behind the glass, a girl, a little girl, a young woman maybe, is looking back. She can't see you. She won't object. You can look as long as you like. The light is bad, but she's distinct enough, hair pulled back and her eyes full almond shapes, the size of bay leaves, wide.
It's a novel based on the life of Clara Schumann, the celebrated 19th century concert pianist and composer, editor and teacher and friend of Brahms. We'll talk to Janice about that briefly in a moment, but as we're looking at childhood memory today, it's one of the other books Janice narrated for RNIB I want to look at. This Is Not About Me by Janice Galloway, despite the title, is the story of Janice's childhood. During the recording, I caught up with her in the Talking Books studio.
The one today is called This Is Not About Me, which my publisher has decided to call a memoir, but as far as I'm concerned, it might as well be a novel. So it's a kind of anti-memoir, sort of memoir novel, if that describes it.
Is it about you, though?
Kind of. Well, I'm in it. Let's put it that way. I'm in it, but a lot of other people are in it as well, and it's more about them than it is about me. I thought one of the things I thought I was doing when I was writing it was capturing what it was like in Scotland in the 60s and 70s. We see such a lot of that era, the supposedly epoch-changing era on the television, but it's all based in London and Carnaby Street and sex and drugs and rock and roll. There was very little of sex, drugs or rock and roll in Salkett's, where I lived. My mother, having left my father, couldn't find somewhere to live in 1961, the supposedly swinging 60s. It was still something you didn't do was leave your husband or have a small child. And the place I remembered, and it gradually changing, so that by the 70s, We almost had a form of metrosexuality there. We had gay men in sulcots, which seemed unthinkable in the 60s. I kind of wanted to tape that period. So if that period means anything to anyone, or any of you who have children who are curious as to what on earth it was you did in the 60s and 70s, I hope that book brings some of it back.
Now, was it hard to write or was it quite cathartic?
I find all writing hard. I think you get back what you put in, and I have found all of the books difficult for different reasons. This one was easy in terms of research. This was stuff I remember happening. The difficult part is to be able to draw the line between what you remember and what you think you remember because you've seen a photograph of it or because somebody's told you a story. And, of course, taking yourself back there, it's not hard when you're writing because you're taken up by the technical questions of how to get the language in the right order. But about a week later, if I'd been writing about something traumatic like my mother's death, then I would notice that I had written something that was difficult.
And by calling it This Is Not About Me, both the title and the sort of paradigm that's coming from, did that make it easier?
Oh, way easier. I mean, it's also partly an author's trick. If you can put yourself in a place that's safe to write a book, you're much better off. I used to sing when I was small. This is actually in the book. I used to sing under a table. And a title, if you like, is a kind of table that protects you, the author, and makes you frame the book in a certain way that makes you able to write it.
And you've answered my next question. The research to this book compared to the research for Clara was perhaps a little easier.
Yeah, perhaps a little easier, but the thing about writing Clara was that she kept voluminous diaries and letters. This is Clara Schumann, the wife of Robert Schumann. She's a mid-19th century German woman and spent 3 hours a day writing letters. It's almost unthinkable to us that anyone would spend that amount of time writing letters. So she left a huge amount of evidence about herself, but gave nothing about herself away. I find that children are doing the same thing again. If I keep up with my son on Facebook, but I don't recognise that boy on Facebook. I don't know who that boy is. There's a persona on there, persona-ing for all he's worth. But I still manage to know what he's doing. But from the things he writes down, I get almost nothing about what he thinks. So the fun with Clara was to deduce from the letters what the actual woman herself might be thinking. With This Is Not About Me, the research was more to hand. I did do research. I went back to a primary school and sat at a baby desk. And it takes your breath away that you were ever that small. It's just the most remarkable thing to try and smell what a dinner hall smells like after all those years. It brings an incredible amount back. But then you need to separate what it's useful for other people to know, what is part of a chronology of something that is shared experience, and what just matters to me. And ruthlessly, anything that I think just mattered to me got snipped out. What I've done is I've written the story of a character that I think who can stand in for almost anyone who was growing up in that period.
Now, you mentioned Facebook, and I have said on Facebook and Twitter that I was going to talk to you and asked for questions from listeners. And one that came up once or twice was, I'll ask this version of it. We study the trick is to keep breathing at uni. We found it all very harrowing, yet ultimately hopeful. How do you feel knowing that there are students sitting in a room somewhere, probably right now, tearing your book to bits and possibly reading meaning into it that was never intended?
It's kind of none of my business. You pay for the book. You get to do what you like with the book. You can light the fire with it. You can kill wasps with it. You can do whatever the hell you want. And if studying it in a certain way, including physically tearing it to bits, which I used to do with university books myself, that's entirely your business. You paid your $8.99, it's yours. It's also yours intellectually. You can decide what that book is about. Now, I might violently disagree with you, but that's the beauty of a book. You have your private experience with it. You take it to your private place, right inside your head, and you disappear with that book, and you decide what it means. It's better if, for exam purposes, these poor souls that have to study it for exams, I feel very apologetic to. Nobody writes a book in order that it might be studied. They write it in order that it might be read. I'm much more interested in an individual deciding what that book means or any other book means for themselves than that they're able to pass an exam with it. But if that so happens to be something they've been asked to do because of a course, then yeah, go for it. Really find something that it means for you, and don't worry about placating the demands of examiners. It's much more important that you find what it means to you, and it doesn't matter whether I agree with you or not.
In saying that, you are narrating your own books as well. You're maintaining an ownership as it goes on to the audiobook form. Do you find that's quite important for you? Or could you let an actor translate one of your books onto audio?
Oh, yes, I could definitely do that. I've had Siobhan Redmond read my books, and Siobhan is my dream actress. I love Siobhan. There are other actresses that I would certainly hand things over to. I would find some of them, most of them are female-voiced, but I'd love to hear what an actor made of Clara, for example, because there are times that the men speak. And, of course, I'm having to voice how I think men sound, so why shouldn't a man voice how the women sound? But more often it will tend to be an actress. I'd love that. It's actually quite hard reading a whole book. I think it ended up being 6.5 hours long, the Clara recording. That's an awful lot of listening. You're just delighted somebody wants to listen to it. If somebody wants to listen, I'll read it. That's fine.
You almost said in Solcutts when you were growing up, reading was antisocial. But why now do you think reading is so important?
I always thought reading was important. It was my mother and my sister who thought it was antisocial. And I could see where they were coming from. You disappear inside yourself. You're not engaging with the other people in the room. The telly is antisocial. And yet families sit round it under the impression, like the royal family, under the impression they are sharing some kind of a bonding experience. Twitter is antisocial. Facebook. So much of what we do seems to be antisocial if it takes you within yourself. Because we've become a frenetic kind of series of generations, one after the other. The telly has shifted our perspectives. And we now think that doing stuff means getting outside. Away you go outside and stop reading that book was the mantra of my childhood, was that to sit in one space. People in the 19th century, 18th century were a lot more to terms with that. I think it's got to do with working class hangover. It's somehow bourgeois to be sitting reading a book. If you're doing something, your hands are dirty. You're lifting something up. It's manual labour. And I think it took my mum an awful long time to gather that actually reading a book might be doing something. It changed my life, changed my mother's life. She read biographies of film stars because she wanted to find out how they'd done it. Unfortunately, she never found out. It's got to do with finding a rich man very often, I think, and having a talent that she didn't particularly possess. My sister read all the time. She read a load of American fiction and was very well versed in that, but didn't apply it to her own life because most of that fiction was about cowboys. The books I wanted were books that told me how to change the situation that I was in. And I think people still want to do that. I cannot imagine not being able to read. I think it's one of the most profoundly important things you can do, because other people can tell you what they think, but the way to make up your own mind is to bounce off someone else's words. They're not talking at you, by and large, and even if they are talking at you from something like an RNIB talking book, they're there for you to play with. The author has given you permission to squeeze these words for all they're worth and take what you want. I have friends who have lost their sight and know the awfulness, that the harrowing nature of not being able to read in particular books. They don't miss newspapers so much because there's the radio for the news. You can even listen to the telly. They don't miss a whole bunch of things, but what they profoundly miss is poetry. There is nothing more personal and intimate than reading a poem to yourself. And they profoundly miss contemporary books in particular, because you can get vast ranges of audio CDs and so on for classic books. But what they're really looking for is contemporary lit. And I was delighted to hear that Scottish RNIB was going to start bringing out contemporary Scottish literature, and that's what they're doing, and that means the world to me.
Colin had taped up specs and a haircut like a hedgehog. He was staying with his auntie in a flat in Windmill Street, he said. His ma lived in Paisley. He looked at me through the circle of one lens. Colin, he said. It's Colin. Then he sat down without being asked. He was pale as a mushroom and smelled faintly of mould, but he had a lovely voice. It was soft. You six? He said. I said nothing. Five? You look wee. You any brothers or sisters or that? Nothing. We listened to the gulls in silence, watched a dog bolting from one side to the other of the sand, demented with a find of something dead. A tiny head was flopping on either side of its jaws. You scared? He said. I thought he meant, was I scared of dogs? Which struck me as a funny question. There was no point in fearing an animal. But it wasn't that. You scared to go home?
A clip from This Is Not About Me, written and read by Janice Galloway. TB number 17086. Clara, the novel based on the life of Clara Schumann, also by Janice Galloway, is TB number 13287. Still to come on today's show, a short story from the RNIB writing competition. Red will be educated about my family and other animals. And next, he talks to listener Po Sim, sharing her love for a classic, well, the classic, by Harper Lee.
This is Read On Air.
As an avid book fan who has problems reading print, listener Po Sim spends much of her time tracking down books to listen to. She told me how she sources reading material, and also about the one title she finds herself coming back to again and again.
I was an academic who read profusely. Now I still read, but because I had a corneal disorder, I'm not reading as much as I used to, and I have to apply Celovix eye drops every 2 hours or whenever I'm using my eyes rather heavily.
And if you read print for too long, you get incredibly dry corneas and I believe ulcers on the eye?
Well, I make sure I don't read so excessively that I reach that stage. But what I do is I have wonderful talking books to resort to so that my day is divided between reading the papers and some books with normal print and also listening to talking books, which are wonderful. In the library, in our local library, they don't have a very vast range, but they do have some, and I find them quite adequate. And occasionally, when it's a birthday or the children want to spoil me, I actually get a present of a talking book.
Yes, there's nothing better than opening a new book of any type, especially an audio book. And what genres do you enjoy most?
I'm rather old-fashioned. They would be termed as classical. For instance, a book which I read very early on was Anna Karenina. And then in school, we were all made to read Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. And, the last few years, the most popular book was To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. And they've all grabbed my attention and I found them fascinating.
Have you read Harper Lee's, the sequel or the prequel, as maybe it might be, To Kill a Mockingbird?
I was told she wrote that first, and it was rejected. And in that first book she wrote, Atticus didn't come across as a tremendously sympathetic character. In fact, he was like all the other people in Morecambe, and he certainly supported the notion of the policy that there should be fewer black children admitted to the schools. But, of course, in To Kill a Mockingbird, he comes up trumps. He's tremendous. And I think everyone is in love with Atticus, particularly the film. I think Gregory Peck played Atticus. And also we saw a stage play, which was marvellous some years ago. And Scout was also beautifully played. And, of course, to see the whole picture through the eyes of a young girl was wonderful, was marvellous.
Yes, it is it's a fantastic childhood memoir turned into an amazing book, isn't it?
And I think Atticus was very clear from the start when he was asked to defend Tom Robinson, the black man accused of raping a white girl. And he knew from the start that, he didn't have a very good chance to get him off. But in a sense, he argued so well, and the evidence was such that Tom Robinson couldn't possibly have raped or hit, she's called Mayella Hewitt. And it was the father who burst in on them and accused Tom wrongfully and quite atrociously. And I think, as most people know, what happens after that is that the jury, much to the children's annoyance, because the children, Scout and her brother and a friend called Dill, attended the trial, and they were sure that Atticus, the dad, had got him off, but the jury, of course, had to find him guilty. It's a very moving story because the children had been slightly persecuting a neighbour called Boo Radley, who in fact save them because the father of Mayella, he felt he'd been humiliated for whatever reason over the case, and he had met Atticus and spat in his face, which was disgusting. And he had taken a knife following the children, and his intention was to kill them. And he tried very hard, but Boo, this character, had been following them, and he saved them. And so at the end of the story, finally, the children got a chance to meet this person whom they had been persecuting across the road by trying to look at him. And we all thought, finally, that they're going to meet and be friends. But because you have a great story writer, she wasn't going to have any of that conventional ending. We were told that this kind neighbor just went away back to his own flat and never saw the children again. So in other words, the whole thing, this internal factor was very, very important in the sense that there was no chance that Tom Robinson could ever be found not guilty because this deep hatred was so strong in the residents of Macon that he would be found guilty. And this internal thing was continued. It's a lovely little echo that this neighbour, this having formed the friendship with the children, he too had to go back to his home and look after them from an internal point of perspective. So I rather like that slight subtlety. And of course, it's a beautifully written novel.
When he was nearly 13, my brother Jem got his arm badly broken at the elbow. When it healed, and Jem's fears of never being able to play football were assuaged, he was seldom self-conscious about his injury. His left arm was somewhat shorter than his right. When he stood or walked, the back of his hand was at right angles to his body, his thumb parallel to his thigh. He couldn't have cared less, so long as he could pass and punt. When enough years had gone by to enable us to look back on them, we sometimes discuss the events leading to his accident. I maintain that the Yules started it all. But Jem, who was 4 years my senior, said it started long before that. He said it began the summer Dill came to us, when Dill first gave us the idea of making Boo Radley come out.
Thank you, Possum, for sharing a wonderful title with us. And To Kill a Mockingbird is available from the RNIB Library, TB 2289. And Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman is also available, TB 22087. When I was flicking through the long list of childhood memoirs that my producer and I had come up with, and which one would make a good book to feature on this week's show, my wife Kate came up with a classic we hadn't even thought of. But I'll let her tell you about it.
I recommended that Red should read My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell. It was a book that I didn't think I'd enjoy. It was recommended to me by my grandfather. And I remember thinking, what do I want to do reading a book about somewhere I'd not really heard of at the time, Cyprus, and didn't have a huge amount of interest in. And in a time that seemed to me a long time ago, the 30s. But once I started reading, I was hooked. It's a great story. It's beautifully written. And it's fairly universal. A story of being in a strange place, discovering things, having adventures. Also, knowing Red, he's not very into wildlife and animals. And I thought, well, it'll be interesting to see if he likes it, given that there's quite a lot of animals in there as well as people. And I hope he did.
I blame my parents. They chose to move to Sussex. And when I got to my new school, all the kids had already read My Family and Other Animals the previous year. Some of them could even quote chunks of it from memory. As the only new boy in the class, I wasn't about to admit this yawning gap in my education, so kept quiet and tried to laugh in all the right places, hoping they'd believe I'd read it too. I didn't dare borrow it from the library for fear of getting found out or teased for reading a book for younger children. So I never got round to it, till now. In case there's anyone else who doesn't know the book, it's the first volume of naturalist Gerald Durrell's memoirs, which are, he explains...
This is the story of a 5-year sojourn that I and my family made on the Greek island of Corfu. It was originally intended to be a mildly nostalgic account of the natural history of the island, but I made a grave mistake by introducing my family into the book in the first few pages. Having got themselves on paper, they then proceeded to establish themselves and invite various friends to share the chapters. It was only with the greatest difficulty and by exercising considerable cunning that I managed to retain a few pages here and there which I could devote exclusively to animals.
Gerald was 10 when he and his frankly bonkers family left England in search of sun and warmth, along with his widowed mother and Roger, his devoted dog, are Gerald's three much older siblings. His gun-toting brother Leslie, his diet-obsessed sister Margot, and the insufferable Larry, who became a successful novelist in his own right. The local inhabitants are no less eccentric. In particular, their driver and Mr. Fix-It, Spiros, and Dr. Theodore Stephanides, who encourages Gerald's love of nature. Much of the humour in this very funny book comes from Durrell's descriptions of the human characters and their bizarre behaviour. As such, it's a sitcom made up from heavily fictionalised memories. But underpinning this are his beautiful descriptions of the island and his wonder as he explores its rich natural habitats. He's helped by Dr. Stephanides and a string of more or less unqualified tutors, all of whom are as quirky as his own family. And through the book, we see his approach becoming more scientific, even if his efforts to collect specimens of some of the creatures wreak havoc at home.
Then one day, I found a fat female scorpion in the wall, wearing what at first glance appeared to be a pale fawn fur coat. Closer inspection proved that this strange garment was made up of a mass of tiny babies clinging to the mother's back. I was enraptured by this family, and I made up my mind to smuggle them into the house and up to my bedroom so that I might keep them and watch them grow up. With infinite care, I manoeuvred the mother and family into a matchbox and then hurried to the villa. It was rather unfortunate that, just as I entered the door, lunch should be served. However, I placed the matchbox carefully on the mantelpiece in the drawing room so that the scorpions should get plenty of air, and made my way to the dining room and joined the family for the meal. Dawdling over my food, feeding Roger surreptitiously under the table and listening to the family arguing, I completely forgot about my exciting new captures. At last, Larry, having finished, fetched the cigarettes from the drawing room, and lying back in his chair, he put one in his mouth and picked up the matchbox he had brought. Oblivious of my impending doom, I watched him interestedly. Still talking glibly, he opened the matchbox.
In many ways, the whole book is about man's uneasy relationship with nature, and behind the humour, Durrell, who became an ardent conservationist, reveals how destructive man can be. Durrell's own family are early examples of the tourists who would eventually destroy Corfu's unspoilt beauty. But this is only an undercurrent in a book that is full of joy and fun and discovery. It brought back fond memories of my own childhood bug hunts in the woods behind our house in Sussex, and made me think about the teachers who had inspired my own interests, which made me realise why it was such a good book to give 12-year-olds who might be wondering about what the point of learning stuff at school is. I thoroughly enjoyed this book, and I'm really grateful to Kate for suggesting that I fill this gap in my education. I listened via Overdrive to RNIB Talking Book number 922. As the three-figure number suggests, this is an early recording, and I found the narrator's voice rather ponderous. Using a function also available on Daisy, I increased the playback speed, which made the narrator sound more like Hugh Laurie, and so far more enjoyable. Durrell wrote two sequels to My Family and Other Animals, Birds, Beasts and Relatives, which is TB number 1111, and The Garden of the Gods, TB number 4996. And for a more contemporary autobiography of a naturalist, why not try Chris Packham's recently published memoir, Fingers in the Sparkle Jar, which is available as TB number 23535. Do you have a book that might give me a bit of an education? I'm open to offers. Send me your suggestions via email, readonair@rnib.org.uk.
This is an RNIB talking book.
The beautiful green countryside of October in California reeled by madly. I was guts and juice again, and ready to go.
On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Don't worry about nothing. We're all in this together, yelled Panzo. I saw that was so. Everywhere I went, everybody was in it together.
On the Road swings to the rhythms of 1950s underground America. Jazz, sex and drugs, with Sal Paradise and his hero Dean Moriarty, traveller and mystic, the living epitome of beat.
It was with a great deal of silly relief that these people let us off the car at the corner of 27th and Federal. Our battered suitcases were piled on the sidewalk again. We had longer ways to go, but no matter. The road is life.
Every weekday at 2, with a repeat at 10. Or catch up online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
This is Read On Air.
Now, you've heard me mention the RNIB writing competition, and last year I was delighted to be asked to be a judge. So while we're on the subject of childhood memories, I thought I'd share this story by Marie England with you. It was a very worthy joint third winner. So, take a listen to Flood.
Flood, by Marie England. Let's run, Lily said, grabbing my hand. The walk to school that day was endless. It seemed to have been raining forever. Rain streamed from my gabardine, the drenched fabric slapping the back of my knees. I can't go any faster, I said. The unforgiving hardness of my clogs pressed against my feet. An hour into our lessons, Miss Black, our teacher, announced that any children from the Irwell Valley area must go home immediately as the river had flooded. Straight home now, she warned. It can only get worse. You need to get home. I tugged on my still dripping coat. Its cold wetness pressed against my skin. Lily and I joined a group of kids from our class and moved towards the open door to the playground. One of the teachers stood, hurrying us along. Already, the chill outside air had swallowed the warmth of the school building. I imagined the escaped river surrounding my house and carrying it away. So often I'd walk by the river, smelt the sour odours of its waters, seen the rubbish swirling like drowned things. Come on, said Lily. But neither of us moved from the playground. Lily had a dinner ticket, which would allow her a free school meal. Because my father worked full-time at the local gasworks, I had to take a packed lunch of anything that we had available in the house that day. Sometimes my mouth would water at the thought of the hot dinner the ticket children would get. Although Lily often complained, saying the meat was full of fat and horrible chewy bits. Teresa Donegan ran past us, calling for us to go with her. If you're going, can I have your dinner ticket? I asked her. She thrust it into my hand. You'll get caught in the flood if you don't come now, she called as she ran on towards the gates. Lily had been right. The food was disgusting. The mashed potatoes slopped around my plate and pieces of the meat wound themselves around my teeth like elastic. We sat, Lily and I, the food congealing on our plates, and knew we must try to get home. The rain had stopped. The air was still like a breath held before a growl. Halfway between the school and our street, we could smell the river, and before we knew it, the water was swirling around our ankles like rancid soup. Despite my efforts to keep my mouth tight shut, I could taste the scent of rotten eggs, and the food in my stomach began to move restlessly. My nose and eyes stung with needles of fear as the water, like hands of ice, reached my knees. The two soldiers appeared then, kindly giants that swept us up from the monster's grip. Before we reached my house, the water was up to the soldier's chest. His rough jacket chafed against my wet legs.
It was as if the world had become one massive river, unfamiliar and terrifying. The front door was nailed shut. My mother called from the bedroom window. "Round the back! It's the only way in now!" "I thought you drowned," she said as we made our way upstairs. Her words sounded full of reproach. "Why couldn't you just come straight home? I saw Teresa Donegan pass over half an hour ago." The front bedroom was filled with smoke and dust from the fire my parents had managed to build in the rarely used grate. My mother told me it had almost cost her life to get the coal from the scuttle downstairs. The wind rattled the loose window panes. In the darkening street, the water level was still rising. I could hear the monster's wet breath, now just below the bedroom sill. Sharp snaps of dry, burning wood sounded loud in the room. I wondered how we would all sleep tonight with the danger looming so close. Then I saw her, my Betsy Ragdoll. She lay small and stranded in the middle of my parents' double bed. I reached for her to take her to a place of safety, the doll's cradle my father had made for me. I'd been delighted with the gift. My father had presented it to me on Christmas morning, unwrapping it from the old tablecloth that he said I could use as a doll's blanket. I knew he must have spent time making it for me during the evenings after long days at work. I reached out to hug him in thanks, but we were not a hugging family, and the gesture slid silently away between us. "We had to burn the cradle. We needed the wood for the fire," my mother said, not taking her eyes from the fire. Her words, as blunt as ancient scissors, hacked at my insides, leaving a ragged ache. "I'll make another one. When I have the time to spare, and the wood," my father said. Without looking at me, he leant closer to the fire. They were sad, hopeless words, and for some reason I imagined the three little pigs, their fear and helplessness as the wolf prepared to blow down their house. As if to mock me, a loud crack came from the fire as the flames devoured the cradle. Sitting with my parents in that room, with the heat of the fire, I still felt the chill of the water. That day, during the flood of 1946, I began to know the fragility of safety.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and interviewees. And thanks too to everyone who's been in touch about their reading groups, the books you've been enjoying, and those of you who have given me ideas for books to read up on. Next week, we'll be asking the question, what makes a good book? I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you'd like to get in touch about that or anything you've read, I'm just an email away. The address to write to is readonair@rnib.org.uk. Until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.